your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
And good morning from the Mighty Boo, KBOO Portland. It is just a minute before 9 o'clock. Join us in 1 hour for Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a special report from Guerrero, Mexico on the kidnapping of dozens of students and student teachers. Also, will the U.S. and Iran reach a nuclear agreement that end the crippling U.S. sanctions? And a Palestinian-American poet on the latest Israeli massacre in Gaza. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews Claudia Rankine, Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, about her provocative meditation on race, citizen, and American lyric. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, host SW Concert speaks with three local writers and artists whose comic titles will be premiering this month. Taki Soma and Michael Oming are debuting their new title, Synergy. And David Walker has adapted the legendary blaxploitation film Shaft to the comics page. That is all coming up this morning. Stick around. Up next, though, it's Teresa Mitchell, hosting Press Watch with news you're not supposed to know. That's next on KBOO.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian Compa and Rara, and Antillean Zouk share the airwaves with African High Life, Afrobeat, Congolese Soukous, Malian Blues, Juju, and South African Kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
I'm Dime Roberts. In 1989, I took a trip to Taiwan with my mother and produced a radio documentary about our relationship. It's called Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song.
Well, I know our Buddha take me to heaven. I didn't want to come by. She told me, it's not my time yet. If my time come, that's my home.
Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song won the Peabody and was played all over the world. For the 25th anniversary, I've turned this personal radio production into a film. Join me November 21st at 8 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for the first ever screening of Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the KBOO homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Gets to be this time of year, and that music starts up with the sleigh bells, and this is a tune that actually refers to sleighing. It's called Troika, and you know, sounds like Christmas music. So just let that be. It's gone on for years. But this is Press Watch, actually, and Press Watch is a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. And I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's a Tupolev double-prop long-range nuclear bomber From the New York Daily News, boiling tensions with the West over the Ukrainian crisis prompted Russia to flex its military might Wednesday by expanding patrols of its nuclear-capable bombers all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. Now, I picked the New York Daily News so that I can load on some snark and give you an idea of the sort of thing that people are hearing from Fox News and CNN. And boy, is it a load. But anyway, returning to the text, Russia's decision to beef up regular patrol missions by its long-range bombers from the Arctic Ocean to the Caribbean came as the top NATO commander accused Moscow of flooding eastern Ukraine with troops and weapons. Did you get that? Flooding eastern Ukraine with troops and weapons. Ukraine's a big territory. In your mind's eye, turn to the map of Europe, and you've got Russia over there on the right, right? Then you got Europe over there on the left, and they're both part of Asia, actually. You don't hear or think of it that much. You ever heard of the continent of Europe? I've heard that phrase all my life, but you know, there ain't no continent of Europe. It's a peninsula of Asia. Boink. Think about that. Anyway, so between Europe and Russia, well, there's Ukraine, and it's to the east of Germany. And during the Second World War, and for that matter, the First World War, there was a whole lot of troops marching over Ukraine, and it's been the site of many a very bloody and very deadly battle. And these days, in the 21st century, we've got satellites, we've got high-flying reconnaissance planes. And now we've got the press telling you that, quote, Moscow has been accused by the top NATO commander of flooding eastern Ukraine with troops and weapons. Well, this is a situation, this is a case where we can say pictures or it didn't happen. It's as simple as that. Pictures or it didn't happen, and it didn't happen. This is just a load that is being laid on you so that you will support the bloody, low-intensity warfare that is being conducted in Ukraine against the people of Ukraine. And yes, Russia is participating to some degree, but flooding, no. I mean, the thing is, Moscow has got thousands of tanks. They want to flood a border? Oh boy, can they flood a border. I'm telling you, the ground would shake. And there would be satellite photos. And I should think that after the tomfoolery of satellite photos in 1990, for example, when the CIA decided to fool the world and the American public into thinking that Saddam Hussein was confronting Kuwait with lines of tanks when he wasn't, that even faked photos would come under some scrutiny. I don't have a great deal of confidence in that, but maybe it would happen. In any event, ain't no pictures, because it isn't happening. There is no flooding of, let's see, what was that? Flooding eastern Ukraine with troops and weapons. Oh my God. I mean, it's just like they're not even trying to lie. Quote, in the current situation, this is quoting New York Daily News. They should put the word news in quotation marks. In the current situation, we have to maintain military presence in the Western Atlantic and Eastern Pacific, as well as the Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico, end quote. That's Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu in a statement. And he also said Russia was increasing forces in the Crimea and the Black Sea Peninsula, which Russia annexed in March. Despite outrage from the White House, the move comes after Russian combat troops, tanks, and artillery were reportedly seen this week entering eastern Ukraine. Pictures or it didn't happen, people. Quoting General Philip Breedlove, who's more like Breed War, but he says, forces, money, support, supplies, and weapons are flowing back and forth across the border completely at will. He said that in Sofia, Bulgaria. But Major General Igor Konashenkov, spokesman for Russia's defense ministry, scoffed at Breedlove's claims, saying, pictures or it didn't happen. No, that's not what he said. He said, we've already stopped taking note on the unfounded statements by NATO's Supreme Allied Commander in Europe on Russia military columns he supposedly saw into the Ukrainian territory, end quote. Russian strategic bombers, meanwhile, capable of carrying nuclear warheads, had been making regular patrols across the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans during the Cold War era following the breakup of the Soviet Union. Patrols were scrapped due to budget constraints, but they're back, and they're better than ever. So just look to the west off the Pacific coast too. And when you see that giant Tupolev bomber with its weirdly interesting counter-rotating props, just wave and say, Strasvice! Because they're back. This is Press Watch. And you are listening to KBOO Portland, and we have an hour today, which means that you can call in and talk and comment. And the number to call with your comments is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. From Reuters, the death toll from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa's three hardest hit countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, has risen to 5,147 out of 14,068 cases at the end of November 9th, as according to the World Health Organization. A further 13 deaths and 30 cases have been recorded in five other countries, Nigeria, Senegal, Mali, Spain, and the United States. There is some evidence, they say, that case incidence is no longer increasing nationally in Guinea and Liberia, but steep increases persist in Sierra Leone. Cases and deaths continue to be underreported in this outbreak, end quote. Some 421 new infections were reported in Sierra Leone in the week to November 9th, especially in the west and north. That's according to the World Health Organization. Ebola is still spreading intensely in Sierra Leone's capital of Freetown, with Koinedougou and Cambia, northern regions, now emerging areas of concern. The virus is spreading rapidly in Guinea's southwest near the Liberian border and to a lesser extent in Sigiri bordering Mali. And the World Health Organization is calling for a high level of vigilance due to the district's proximity to its neighbor. There have been a total of four confirmed and probable cases in Mali and four deaths. A two-year-old girl who died of Ebola last month in Mali was among the fatalities, but her infection was not linked to the latest cases. And departing from the text, that's interesting because that was thought to be a zero patient source of infection. But no, they've had four deaths unrelated, which in a sense is worse news. Anyway, returning to the article, more than 90 people were quarantined across the Mali capital of Bamako on Wednesday after a 25-year-old nurse died of Ebola after treating a Guinea man. And there's more on that article at Reuters. Now, we need to talk about the election. I bet you thought the election was over. I bet you thought Measure 92, calling for labeling of genetically modified organisms on products, had failed. But you might be wrong if you think that, because actually the election isn't over. Let me lay this on you from 6th of November from Jane Ayers of Reader Supported News. Big ag monies might have broken the state of Oregon records for pouring the most amount of money into a state initiative, but Oregonians have held their own in the highly charged vote on GMO labeling Measure 92. This morning, she's talking about 6th of November, with pending results showing a 50.61 no to 49.39% yes, the Oregonian newspaper decided to call the outcome with a win for no votes. Eric Sample, spokesman for the Multnomah County Elections Division, said, "I don't know why the Oregonian would call this vote as a win for the no GMO labeling. We are still counting 33,000 more ballots in our county, along with additional ballots from other counties, and will not be finished until early evening. These are mail-in ballots and require extensive verification of signatures, etc." End quote. And Jane Ayers wrote, "Multnomah County has been shown to have close to 70% voters in favor of GMO labeling." Dr. Michael Hansen, a senior scientist with the Consumers Union, stated today, "It is such a close vote that the state of Oregon could demand a recount. Multnomah County is the one county in Oregon that can make the GMO labeling campaign win. And why is it taking so long to get the results? Are there election monitors there? It seems fishy," end quote. With the extremely tight margin between yes and no on this initiative, a premature call by the Oregonian on this vote might not be serving the public interest, she writes. Major news organizations took it as a done deal. She writes, multinational companies like Monsanto, DuPont, and Pepsi contributed over $19 million to defeat this GMO labeling initiative, and grassroots organizers in Oregon are still very focused on the true outcome of the highly sensitive votes of Multnomah County. Talking about Measure 92, David Bronner, president of Dr. Bronner Soap, donated $1 million to the Right to Know aspect of GMO labeling. Tom Hormel, heir to Hormel Foods Corporation, added another $500,000 for labeling GMOs, which countered the company's contribution of $350,000 against labeling. Dr. Hansen of the Consumers Union also said today, and this is November 6th, mind you, talking about November 6th, today is not the 6th, quote, "It is curious to me why Monsanto dropped another 1.5 million on the last day. We are watching these last ballots being counted as very significant, and we don't buy that the vote can be called one way or the other yet, end quote. Though the Multnomah election spokesman Eric Sample stated they would update the results two times on Wednesday afternoon, the numbers cited all day were never changed, even though the site showed that updates supposedly occurred. Now, you've been listening to KBOO. Oh, you probably heard from Greg Palast, and I'll bet you can get a guess as to what's actually happening, especially when you hear that $1.5 million was contributed with at the last minute. What could that be for? Well, let me explain. First, let me tell you of some letters that I sent. I sent an email to Eric Sample, Multnomah County Election, and he wrote back. He said, "Thanks for contacting us. I'll answer your questions below. It is important to understand that ballots are still being counted as we receive additional ballots from other counties." This was November 7th, I believe he was writing. "Complete duplication of machine unreadable ballots and resolve challenge ballots. We will be posting additional results by 5 p.m. today and additional updates next week. All results are unofficial until we certify by the 24th of November. Letters have been sent to voters with challenge ballots." Keep that phrase in mind, challenge ballots. "And voters have until the 18th of November. How many days is that? Just a few days to resolve the challenge. The list of challenge ballots becomes public record on the 12th, giving candidates or campaigns the opportunity to contact voters with challenges." So here we are. He wrote, "Please let me know if you have any additional questions. Thanks, Eric, Multnomah County Elections." So I wrote, and then he quotes what I had written to him before, which was, "As a local public affairs broadcaster, I would like to ask a few questions about this most recent election. First, Multnomah County shows 289,725 ballots cast total." Mind you, this is a few days ago. "Whereas the total votes for and against Measure 92 are only 284,980, the Measure 92 race was hotly contested in Multnomah County, yet it seems 4,745 voters did not vote for nor against the measure. Is this assumption correct?" And Eric wrote, "The current number of ballots counted is, as you stated, 289,725, and the vote tally of 92 for yes and no adds up to 284,980. The difference in numbers are undervotes where the voters did not vote on the issue. There may also be a few overvotes where both yes and no were marked. There are more ballots to count. So final official results with precinct level data will show the exact over and under vote count." And that number changed, by the way, departing from this this letter. And it now stands 1,582 higher for the total ballots to count on this issue. The latest number is 286,562, and so you might want to ask where the other 1,500 votes come from. Leave that question hanging for a minute. Second question I asked, and I admit this one was a bit unfair. Measure 91, a similarly contested measure, shows 1,017 more votes in Multnomah County than Measure 92. Why would so many people vote as far as Measure 91 and then leave their opinion on Measure 92 blank? And of course, he wrote, "More voters chose to vote for or against Measure 91, the marijuana legalization initiative." But keep that in mind, too, because that kind of changed. But anyway, going back to the letter, my third question, and I will present Eric's answer. My third question was, "How many ballots were successfully challenged?" There's that word, challenged, "in Multnomah County in this most recent election, and by whom and on what basis?" And he wrote, "At this point, challenge ballot numbers are going down as challenges are resolved. In Oregon, voters have up to 14 days after the election to resolve the challenge by either providing a new registration signature to match the return envelope or signing the unsigned return envelope. All challenge voters have received a letter giving them an opportunity to act within a 14-day window. That list of challenges becomes public record on the 12th of November, so candidates and campaigns can contact the challenge voters. All of the challenge ballots that are resolved will be counted as an example in the November 2012 general election. Of the 370,142 ballots cast, less than 2,100 ballots were left in a challenge status." So I responded, "Dear Eric, thank you for your prompt reply. I do notice that you do not answer the question of who is challenging the ballots and on what basis, though I do see that more information is coming out on the 12th. And of course, the reason I wrote that is I really want to know about these challenges because, frankly, unless the world is turned upside down, that's what that $1.5 million is about at the last minute. Coming from Monsanto et al., it's for people to go, well, let me explain. Here's the thing with challenged ballots, for anyone who doesn't already know. Groups like True the Vote or other bunches associated with Karl Rove And conservative groups will train people to do what they call citizen vote monitoring, which is legally available to all citizens, especially available if you can get in on the county commission to count the ballots as an official. But the secret trick is they challenge the registration or the signature or whatever of ballots that they know are coming from a progressive area or a progressive population, or they challenge ballots with black or Hispanic seeming names in order to throw the election to conservative whites who will fall in line with billionaires and corporations like Monsanto. So I know you're just going to be shocked by this, but there was just a tremendous amount of challenged ballots in Measure 92. Anyway, he wrote back. Eric, Multnomah County Elections, wrote back. He said, sorry, I missed that part. Challenge ballots are done by election officials only. There are a couple of categories for challenges. Every return envelope signature is checked against the voter registration signature. If the signature does not match, a letter is sent to the voter who has 14 days after the election to provide a new signature so we can attempt to match it. The other big category are unsigned return envelopes. Same process with a letter to the voter giving them an opportunity to come into the office and sign the return envelopes. Let me know if you have any other questions. Eric, Multnomah County Elections, and I responded. Thanks for responding again quickly. As you may have guessed, I was concerned about ballot challenge tactics because of the nationwide electioneering tactics that had been exposed by journalists like Greg Palast. I will be looking more closely at the results on the 12th. So now it looks to me like we have the classic challenge all the liberal votes scenario. And if we want to pass Measure 92, yes, I said if we want to pass, that's in the future tense, Measure 92, we had better get out, get this information out, and get all of the challenged votes back in. And if you don't want to pass Measure 92, because I got to be even-handed here, then you better stop people from voting or something. I don't know. Well, I guess you can I'm sure some of those no votes got challenged as well. That's going to happen. Anyway, what I'm saying is vote. I feel safe doing that. There's a call to action that I can probably get away with. Vote. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. This is Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And speaking of Monsanto, they reached a $2.4 million settlement with Pacific Northwest wheat farmers who sued after unapproved genetically modified wheat, which the Chinese hate and won't pay for, was discovered growing in eastern Oregon. The discovery in May 2013 prompted Japan and South Korea to temporarily suspend some wheat orders. And the European Union called for more rigorous testing of U.S. shipments. Monsanto has not admitted liability, but has agreed to pay a total of $250,000 to wheat growers associations and $2.125 million into a settlement fund. So, and speaking of elections, 2 years ago, the biggest donors and operatives in the Republican money universe, Karl Rove, casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, and the Koch brothers and their donor network spent hundreds of millions of dollars to defeat President Obama and retake the Senate. They got nothing. It was an embarrassment. This year, they won big. That's an article by Andy Kroll and Mother Jones, who writes, Rove's groups, American Crossroads, a super PAC, and Crossroads GPS, his dark money-funded siblings, spent heavily in 10 Senate races. The Republican won in at least six of those elections. If Republican Dan Sullivan defeats Senator Mark Begich in Alaska, and GOP Representative Bill Cassidy, Mary Landrieu in Louisiana's runoff next month, Rove will end up 8 for 10. The Sunlight Foundation calculates Crossroads GPS return on investment, that is a success rate of GPS spending to elect or defeat candidates, at an impressive 96%. So we're talking about a corruption, basically. Talking about American corruption, corruption in elections. Is that redundant now? Corrupt elections, election corruption. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And it's time to pull up the election results from Multnomah County. And let's see, I pulled up update number 11 from November 4th, which gave the numbers which I gave earlier. Not from November 4th, from the November 4th election. Let's see what update 11 says on Measure 92. I'm a-looking. You can be calling in if you like. I don't think that's going to work because I'm on radio, except that maybe Thomas is ready to talk. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Hey, I just had a few thoughts about this incipient lame duck session of our illustrious president here. I noticed that we're getting a few nuggets cast down as far as internet neutrality. Of course, you know, everybody who backed, you know, the presidency's been trying to get a decisive vote on internet neutrality for what, you know, 6 years now?
Which is interesting because he's talking out of both sides of his mouth. He's pushing TPP, which would wipe out internet neutrality.
Right, exactly. So you get the ceremonial status of rolling that out, and everybody applauds it. And, of course, the fellow, the Wheeler, Mr. Wheeler, who's the chairman of the FCC, who was appointed by Obama, was another one of the corporate malefactors and, you know, and former telecommunications industry business people. So, you know, really, it's sort of set up for fail. You know, you get a symbolic action that's sort of kind of destined to fail. Hopefully something will happen, but then again, hope doesn't really play much of a role. And then also I was thinking, too, about these new words with China about limiting CO2. I suspect that China was already going to begin limiting its CO2 because it's been rolling out its wind power and its solar so powerfully that it's probably going to be in a position to do that anyway. And I would imagine that it's a safe phasing.
Yeah, why burn oil if it's cheaper for a solar panel?
Yeah, and, you know, there's already all sorts of international, like, world trade agreement blockages and threats because China has lowered the cost of solar panels so much that companies or countries like Germany, you know, countries, manufacturers in those countries are already blocking the flooding of cheap, you know, ironically, the one cheap import that could help things from China, you know, is energy technology. But at any rate, I think, you know, these are window dressing, and I think the real Trojan horse bomb that's going to happen is going to be this TPP, and we can see that it's already gotten just nominal coverage in the press, or they're completely glossing over the fact that essentially what this is an extensive corporate-written charter for international corporate governance that completely shuts off a democratic process, not just in labor standards, environmental standards, energy autonomy. Basically, no matter what the voters of any signatory or citizens, voters of any signatory country would want, basically you have an unelected panel of corporate leaders who are going to could veto it. So essentially the time.
Oh, you're absolutely right about that. I'd like to quote Public Citizen on that. And by the way, I think of TPP as standing for Taking the People's Paycheck. Public Citizen says it's a massive, controversial free trade agreement currently being pushed by big corporations and negotiated behind closed doors. Gee, I wonder why they want to hide it. By officials from the United States and 11 other countries. It's going to offshore millions of American jobs. That wasn't a problem before. We don't mind offshoring our jobs, do we? It's going to roll back Wall Street reforms because we can trust them, right? It's going to sneak in SOPA-like threats to internet freedom. It's going to ban Buy American policies needed to create green jobs. It's going to jack up the cost of medicines, expose the U.S. to unsafe food and products, and empower corporations to attack our environmental and health safeguards. And that certainly includes the climate.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you know, this completely strips it, all of those issues. It strips power from the democratic process. And, you know, this is exactly the kind of thing that our last Democrat president, Bill Clinton, did. I mean, it was in sort of the 11th hour of his presidency that he signed the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which was completely gutted the Depression-era, you know, Glass-Steagall Act to keep banks from becoming gambling casinos. And also signed the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which, guess what, made derivatives possible, and not only possible, but made these derivatives, these phony baloney banking derivatives that exploded the economy, made them essentially unregulatable. So, you know, really, this isn't really surprising. I mean, you think about the Commerce Secretary that Obama just appointed, is, you know, Penny Pritzker, who comes from essentially a crime family whose banking activities were at the absolute core of the mortgage fraud. So, you know, contrary to all of the wistful fantasy that all of us, you know, wistful Obama voters, first we're going to wait 6 months for him to do something, then the second term, and, you know, now the end of the second term. You know, the reality is that, you know, this man is a known quantity, the Democratic Party, and I would term coin a new term. You know, we talk about the progressives in the Democratic Party. Well, guess who's in control? The regressives.
I was just thinking about that on the way here, actually. I mean, the thing is about the Democratic Party, any party really, but, you know, Democratic Party, this definitely counts, is that you can get all the reformers you want in, and they need these people. They need people who are fresh-faced and sincere, and they come in, and they want, you know, they want change. But those people are going to be squeezed out because it's a money game, and there's plenty of, I mean, for every one of those, right. there's 10 other people who eventually realize that there's a steady paycheck and licking the shinola right off the boots of big business.
That's
and
right.
so we and have, it, yeah.
That's right. And the thing is that it's an insider's club, and of course it's a sucker's game. It's a calculated game because the formula of lesser of the evils, they know that they've got a captive. They've done all the polling. They know that the rank-and-file Democrat mainstream Joe and Jill Democratic voters are going to, at the end of the day, sigh no matter what they do and vote for them. So essentially it's a description of a trap. And that keeps the, you know, these regressives. And here's this: you hold on to your fingertips. I'm thinking about actually joining the Democratic Party, not due to any illusion that by voting straight up and down on these for these candidates, but I'm thinking that there's a possibility for people joining the party and going in there and launching a direct attack.
Oh, sure. There's people who join the Republicans with the same idea, and you know, I've done things like I joined True the Vote as Trudy. Trudy joined True the Vote so I could find out what the hell they were up to. And let's see, I got, I got information from, what the hell was the name of that CIA business organization? I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, you know, it's handy. I can tell, they say where the battleships are. Sure, that can be a handy thing to do. Listen, you've had a long ride on, and so for the sake of the listenership, I should go to the next caller, and I really appreciate your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Now, I just got news release from Oregon Secretary of State. It says Oregon voters have until November 18th to fix unsigned ballots or ballots that signatures that don't match. Now, this is not the only thing either. We need to find out what ballots were challenged. And it says, Dateline Salem, Oregon voters have until close of business on Tuesday, November 18th, to cure any signature problems on their ballots. If the signature problem is not fixed by the deadline, the ballot will not be counted. The list of voters with ballot signature problems will be made